Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Cowlin, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Well, welcome to the Risk Revolution podcast, coming to you this month live from the Q1 Scientific Conference in County Kildare in Ireland. A very wet Ireland this morning, I must say. My name is Nuala Cowlin, and this is my co-host, Valerie Mulholland. We're all members of the Pharmaceutical Regulatory Science team at TU Dublin. We've all done our PhDs there, and we routinely research risk-based approaches for the pharmaceutical and life science sector. We host a monthly podcast to discuss all things risk and quality across the life science sector, and we cover topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech and even combination products. We heard those from those today. We try and shake up the paradigm to revolutionise the way in which we perceive and proactively manage risk. So if you haven't already subscribed, please do so. There's lots of interesting guests in our back catalogue and lots of insights to keep you up to date. So firstly today, we would like to thank Karina Legg from Q1 and the whole Q1 scientific team for the invitation to join you here today. We're really looking forward to some great interaction from our learned panel of speakers who have joined us today. And of course, we're open for business for questions from the floor too, so please don't be shy. So our topic today is stability under pressure. And as usual at Risk Revolution, we are looking at this topic through the lens of risk. Now, as all of you know from what you've learned from all of the other speakers today, shelf life isn't just about counting days. It's about managing risk, and it's really about managing risk to our patients and our businesses. So today, we hope to unpack how the life science industry is evolving its approach to pharmaceutical, medical device, or combination product stability with faster product cycles and complex supply chains and all the new science that's emerging on degradation. We are asking, is your stability strategy ready for what's next? So in order to think about what's coming next, let's start with where are we coming from? So let's explore a little bit around the traditional stability mindset. And why has stability historically been treated quite conservatively within our sector? What is the real-world impact of over-design, whether it's in terms of extending testing or redundant zones that we include? And are there tensions between global shelf life expectations and science-based limits? So over to you, Val. What do you think?
Thanks, Nuala. Well, I'm actually just going to take you up on something you said there, Nuala, about counting days. I actually managed a stability department way back in the dark ages of the 80s. Maybe I'm giving away my age here. But as I audit and review facilities today, it strikes me that this space mightn't have changed as much as we'd expect or as it should have. Like for decades, we've been setting stability protocols, a little bit like calendar clockwork, I call it. 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. Take a sample, test it, see does it meet the spec, tick the box, write the protocol. You know, it just seems, specification milestones seem to be the driver. But is this calendar compliance really answering the bigger question, which is what could go wrong with this product over time, and how do we manage to detect that before it reaches patients? So how do we relate it back to our manufacturing operations and our risk strategies? What are we learning from our stability protocols as they evolve? I mean, calendar-driven testing is like, it's like following the kind of standard issue maps. Do you remember those ordnance survey maps from the 1950s telling you where you should be going? Whereas I think risk-based approaches compares more like a GPS system telling you where you actually are at this point in time. So maybe, you know, there are strategies that allow for more real-time knowledge, getting it and channeling back to the manufacturing operations as a more real-time feedback loop. So, Nuala, earlier we did some polls with the studio audience in here, and I'd like to thank them for that. And one of the questions we asked was, should stability protocols be designed to actively answer a risk question rather than simply follow a calendar to meet the spec? And we gave the audience three options, and I'll just go through the options first, and then I'll give the results, if I may. So the first option was, yes, stability should be risk-focused, identifying potential failure modes and mitigation strategies. The second option was, a hybrid approach might work best, calendar plus risk elements. And finally, no, the way we're going, regulatory compliance, label claims are the priority, and therefore the calendar approach maybe is sufficient. Well, the good news is only 5% opted for C. So there is an onboarding of risk-based approaches, partially or maybe more extensively, and it was practically 50-50 there, I think, in terms of people's views. So I do think, I suppose we can deduce maybe from that only 5% are saying plough on with the calendar approach. Others recognise that, you know, there are risk questions in there that maybe we could embed a little bit more closely and follow a little bit more closely. But I wonder how much of that we actually do in reality. And I thought it a little bit peculiar when I read ICHQ1, the draft, that it didn't align more closely with the risk standard ICHQ9 or 1, with the idea of having a risk question. And perhaps it's a risk question that drives your stability study, rather than maybe performing a study that is looking to achieve a predetermined endpoint. And that's particularly important, I think, as well, when you look at post-approval change, introducing a possible change, be it site, be it vendor, be it material. You know, they introduce additional variability, perhaps, and uncertainties, and that our risk controls can respond to those as quickly as possible, with signals from our stability programs included. You know, that's science-driven, really, rather than finding out a little too late. So we did ask our audience a second question, which was, do you think that teams involved in managing and or designing stability study programs are aware of the enhanced regulatory trends towards adoption and implementation of risk-based approaches and the recent updates in QRM, quality risk management expectations, that are set out in the ICHQ 901, which was updated in 2023. And the answer is, well, 68% of our respondents agreed with the second option, which was no. Team members may be aware, but maybe are not adequately trained or experienced in recent updates in QRM. That was a little bit disappointing, wasn't it, Nuala? And then we had 11%, all members of the stability study teams are well-versed. That was good news. And then 21% said they mightn't be fully au fait with recent QRM practices, but they are supported by colleagues in global QRM resources or whatever. So look, at I think what I'm seeing here, maybe it's early days for enhanced approaches from a risk-based approach perspective anyway. Maybe there are more discussions to be had about why we're doing some of these studies and whether, as we're doing them and considering often the substantial costs involved with them, particularly, you know, with biological products, and they're very, very expensive, maybe we could use them more proactively to drive risk understanding and knowledge. What are your thoughts there, Nuala?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Particularly, I was a little bit taken aback that over two-thirds of the respondents in the audience poll said they don't feel that they're up to date or comfortable or experienced enough with some of the new risk-based approaches, particularly coming in ICHQ 9 or 1. And I was surprised, as you were, Val, around the fact that the new draft, Q1 draft, which is extensive, there's a lot in it. It takes a long time to work your way through it. I wasn't surprised to hear Catherine say this morning that there's 1,000 questions have gone into the ICH in regard to it. But I am disappointed to see that the Q9 or the Q1 review is really looking at how can we use risk-based approaches to support our justifications for perhaps, you know, less extensive number of tests or over different times or the introduction of predictive testing, and not really looking at it from a risk question perspective. And I know there was an earlier question to Declan's speech earlier on today around at what point should you respond or how should you best respond to an out of trend. I always like to say that out of trend protects the business. Out of spec is there to protect the patient. So if you're not responding appropriately to your out of trend and following up and doing adequate inspections, with this lens of risk of saying, well, what is it telling us? Is this out of trend giving us information, or how might we establish what it is trying to tell us by doing a thorough investigation rather than maybe a bit of a checkbox investigation and Kappa? Then it would be, it's really important. It is about expanding our process understanding. And we'll come back to that again, I think, Val. You had your next topic you were putting your sights on, Val.
You see, I did. I had another topic that was bothering me this morning when I drove to this, by the way, beautiful hotel here. Yeah. For those who are listening to us on the pod, it was originally a country manor. I think it dates back to the 1860s.
Right.
Which was about when I was analysing stability data back in the day. So, and back then, I think we were analysing it much the same way as we're analysing it today, you know, linear regression being the main tool in town. And I see in the latest revision, that extensive tome you referred to there, Nuala, that, it's clear that other methods are now acceptable as well, and they're open to different explorations of models. Linear regression has always been the regulatory default, but you know, in the area of complex biologics and nonlinear degradation pathways and accelerated studies and the need maybe for more real-time feedback, you know, are we continuing to use all these models appropriately? So I guess, you know, the question I was wondering was, are we using sort of 1970s stats to make 21st century decisions? So we did a third poll with the audience. We've been very busy all day, Nuala. Third poll with the audience. And we asked them, how many of you believe linear regression alone accurately predicts the shelf life of biologics or complex formulations? And here, it was very interesting, 65% went for the answer that perhaps it oversimplifies reality. 30% said sometimes, but not always. It's not always a good predictor. And a very small number, about 5%, thought it was sufficient. Now, maybe they are the more knowledgeable folks in how to use it as well, so we have to kind of take that on board. So I think maybe it's time to ask a question of a few experts in this space then. And we're delighted to have some guests from this conference with us. And I'd just like to introduce them first, but preface it by saying that, you know, just to note that their views that they're sharing with us here on the podcast today are personal and don't necessarily represent the views of their company. But we are delighted to welcome first Declan Lowney, who is the Director of Stability Studies in Analytical Development, Biologics, within Johnson & Johnson Innovative Medicine, R&D. That's a whole new big long name for Johnson & Johnson now, isn't it? We're only getting used to that. And there he provides technical leadership in stability science and enhanced and expertise in stability-related matters and advising them through the ICH and regulatory guidance updates. Now, he's been there a long time. We'll mutter over the time frame, will we? But he does. He's been involved in many, many products over that time. So, Declan, if I could ask you, you know, if we claim to be risk-based, are we still assuming that all degradation is linear? And at what point, you know, does our attitudes to linear degradation pathways become a compliance habit rather than maybe the best scientific models we could be following? Does that make sense to you, Declan?
It does, yeah. I think from our perspective, you know, it's always going, our response is always going to be data driven. You know, we look at the data, we work with our statisticians and apply the most appropriate statistical model. Sometimes that is a linear regression model, or at times we'd use more advanced statistics such as Bayesian models and things like that. So I suppose the driving thing for us is the safety to the patient at the end of the day, and ensuring that the product at the end of that proposed shelf life still is of the highest standard of quality, and that, you know. So, and if you look at the regulatory approach and the ICH approach for biologic shelf life is based on real-time stability data. So we're not using extrapolation to claim a longer shelf life.
Yeah. And just in terms of other tools you mentioned, you know, Bayesian models and the like there, do you think our regulatory reviewers and indeed maybe site inspectors are, you know, coming on this journey with us as quickly as we might like? Or is it what could we do to encourage, you know?
Yeah, I would feel that the regulators are moving that, particularly in the major markets of US, Canada, EU. You know, they're very aware of the statistical tools that are available to model complex data and evolving with that. You know, as we present our approaches in our regulatory filings, we do give that explanation of the models used, of the limits, you know, and the constraints that we put on the data. So it's clear and it's transparent for them to interpret.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for that. Maybe I'd ask a similar question to our other panellist here, Mark, who is a fellow of the Royal Society of Chemistry. And you've been involved for 30 years in analytical chemistry, served as an honorary secretary and treasurer of the Royal Society, I know. And you have been working with process development and product development since for decades, I think, at this point, right? At very senior levels. And I know you're in huge demand now as a trainer and in areas such as chromatography, spectroscopy, data integrity, and stability. So what do you think we're doing enough to promote and explore more advanced models of analysis of stability data?
That's a very good question. I think traditionally we've over-relied on the linear model, but I've certainly been involved in many projects where we've seen non-linear data trends. I think the regulators are happy, with appropriate justification, to receive stability data based on non-linear trends. And we saw some excellent results from Luke's presentation earlier, right, talking about how we can better model stability trends. And I think that's one of the... I think I would agree with you that there's quite a lot to be a bit critical about in the Q1 guidance. But one of the things that I think is useful about it is the discussion on using stability modelling based on Arrhenius kinetics. And I would hope that as part of the training package for the Q1 guidance, we'd see some exposition on how that might look in practice.
Which leads me nicely to the second question for you. I mean, do you have views on what the training material should include to encourage enhanced data approaches?
Yes. Okay. So I think if we just take a step back and look at what we would have wanted to see in Q1, but isn't there, I can see potentially the opportunity for the training package to cover not just stability trending, but other deficiencies in the package as well, and to help industry to frame an application that to fill the missing stuff that we would have hoped to have seen in Q1, but haven't.
Yeah, and that was our experience, wasn't it, Nuala, with ICH Q9 or 1 when it was released in 2023, was that the guidance itself was probably quite constrained in terms of what the regulators could maybe agree on including, but that they seem to have far more freedom to maybe explore thoughts and suggestions in the training material. So I would say to our listeners and to the audience that those training materials that accompany those ICH guidances are a very valuable additional resource and should be read, although I'm not always sure people access them as they should, because there's a lot of gold in them, really, isn't there, in terms of additional information. What do you think, Nuala?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And particularly we've seen on the ICH Q9 or 1 training materials that they've accepted materials from interested parties, including TU Dublin and the Pharmaceutical Regulatory Science team. We submitted some case studies and approaches. And they also used some case studies from other associations, industry associations, which gives very practical examples. And that's really where the value can come in those training materials. Don't just read the guide. But do read the guide. I find sometimes I rock up for training and they haven't even read the ICH guideline before you go in the door, even though you're there to do some training with them. But certainly go in and look at those training materials, because it can be very rich in terms of resources that they can include. So we look forward to getting the step 4 for Q. Q1 issued, and then seeing how they play out with the training materials.
Training materials, yeah. We did ask the audience here today what tools or methods they were currently using for stability data analysis. Now, this is a multiple, people could select multiple choices, so it's not necessarily all going to add up to 100. But I did notice that the most popular was linear regression, followed by spreadsheet-based calculations. Then we had bobbing around the 10%, kinetic models, mixed effects or hierarchical models, with about 6.5 saying they use Bayesian models. But that may reflect the complexity of the molecules as well. Yeah. And then finally, a small 6.5 using machine learning or AI-based predictions. And I assume that's in some kind of sandbox at the moment, given Annex 22 and all it has to say about AI applications as well.
Indeed.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and I think, just to hit some of the numbers there, 68% of the audience poll were saying they're still using linear regression. 30% were saying they're using spreadsheet-based manual calculations only. I would have to say, spreadsheets are the evildoer for me, particularly when it comes to risk. I would love to see a little bit more rigor going in around that. And just another couple of points that I'd like to make on what you've just been talking about. Again, with these tools and with the promotion of the advanced models, it's all about, as we said, developing this process understanding, enhancing our ability to understand the variability in our products and what's it doing over time. And one of the key models that we use from a risk perspective and a knowledge perspective is, again, developed by another one of our colleagues, Dr. Marty Lippa, and it's called the Risk Knowledge Infinity Loop, or RKI concept. And really, it's about, as your knowledge is enhanced around your product, your risk is automatically reduced. They're the inverse of each other. So while we have less knowledge about our products, maybe they're new, maybe they're new to the site, maybe they're a brand new technology that we're using, we have to assume we have higher risk and higher uncertainty. And as we become more familiar and we grow our scientific evidence around these products, then we can start to look at reducing, using prior knowledge around of some of our other processes. And I loved Declan's quote from earlier on, which is, for biologics, our process is our product. And therefore, understanding that process is really, really important in terms of being able to justify your approaches. Now, with ICH Q9 or 1, one of the terms that came in the revised 2023 guideline is this concept of risk-based decision-making. Now, luckily, I have Val on my left here. She's the expert. She did her PhD in risk-based decision-making. But I have come to look on the term justification, and we use it all the time when we use our science and data-backed, using the term we're going to justify our approaches, as almost like we're on the back foot. We have to, like when you're explaining, you're losing. So I love to use the term now, we informed our risk-based decision-making based on our scientific evidence, based on our process understanding, and we came to the following decision. And it was a risk-based approach that gave us that outcome. And I just like that concept of we're being proactive about our decision-making, ensuring we have informed, science-based, risk-based decision-making, rather than using the term we're justifying our approach based on our evidence. So it's just something for you to consider from our own revision of the, our reflections on the revision of risk-based approaches that the agencies are out there looking for. So what's next up? Well, it's over to me again. And we thought at this stage we'd look at what's driving some of these changes. Is it on the advancing industry innovation side, or is it on the enhanced regulatory expectations side, or a little bit of both in terms of what's driving some of the changes that are that we're experiencing at the moment? And obviously, we are certainly seeing increased complexity in our formulations in terms of, you know, advanced therapeutics, complex generics, and even in the biologic space. And with that, all the time brings with it the faster speed to market expectations that are coming. Not to mention many of the orphan products that are getting, you know, fast tracked or special designations in terms of use. So in terms of this topic of product innovation and faster speed to market. One of the things when I was reviewing Q1, the draft document, that really triggered a risk question for me was where it states that in addition to the principles of quality by design, as described within ICH Q8 to Q11 and Q12 in terms of the risk-based analytical methods development, and through the enhanced understanding of our critical quality attributes, including our stability impacting CQAs. And it then says, and the impact of the manufacturing process that it can have on these attributes, how are we making this applicable to the design of the overall stability strategy? So it was that section around how much we understand about the impact of the manufacturing process on our stability indicating CQAs. And I just wondered, this prompted me to kind of ask the audience another poll question around how many of you have started to see requests to put pilot scale or CDMO manufacturing batches or non-final manufacturing site batches on stability, not as part of the development studies, but as part of the primary or formal studies for registration or CMC submissions. So in poll question 5, we asked, what have you seen in terms of an increase in the requests from product launch teams for additional stability studies for materials that perhaps have not been produced in the proposed commercial manufacturing site? And we saw that 42% of you said, yes, you have been seeing an increase in this, and you have been facilitating that with justification presenting an acceptable practice. 56% of you are saying that you haven't yet experienced those kind of requests for additional stability studies around some of these third-party manufacturers or CDMO or pilot scale batches. And only 3% of you said we have seen this, but so far we've declined to facilitate this. So what do we see in this response? The fact that, you know, again, we're kind of split 50-50 Many of you are seeing it and trying to accommodate that, and others have not yet experienced this. And I guess for me, it's like, what are the implications then of stability information? All information is good information. All data can be helpful. But if the Q1 draft is referring specifically to the impact that the commercial manufacturing process and site can have on it, how do we then ensure that we're getting comparability or verification with our long-term or real-time studies at the commercial scale? And how are we doing this? And as we always say in the pod, risk management is a science-backed activity, not a compliance or documentation exercise. So your risk-based stability program is a scientifically sound risk control mechanism that's there to protect the patient and the business. So how are we assessing the risk of the differences between what material that we have on stability that may not have come from the final manufacturing site? So I'm kind of interested in perhaps putting that to the team here. But first of all, I just also want to share with you, one of my colleagues in the UK is currently doing a PhD, he's doing a review of 10 years of recall data from within the MHRA from 2015 to 2024. And not surprisingly, I'm sure any of you who are familiar with the recall stats, the number one item that causes us problems around recall has to do with artwork, labelling and packaging issues. Number two in that 10-year period coming up in the UK is stability issues. And number three tends to be linked to the dosage form, you know, whether it's a pre-filled syringe or maybe a vial cap or something like that. But interestingly, within the class two recalls in the UK at the MHRA over the last 10 years, 9 out of 10 class two recalls have been to do with stability issues. Now, there's a thought. 90% of class two recalls over the last 10 years, and I know we're only looking at one agency, but I think it's probably, we could extrapolate on that, I think. So what does this tell us? Either our stability programs are doing an excellent job of protecting our patient and they're detecting any issues out there, or might we also infer that the robustness of our stability programs is not where it could or should be? So it's a kind of a stark figure that 90% of class two recalls are related to stability issues. So I would be interested in exploring that. I don't know, Declan, for you, from a modern risk-based stability program for biopharmaceuticals and for proteins, as you spoke about earlier, how does this concept around making sure that some of the early stability data you might have that may not be at the scale or, within the finished manufacturing site versus your long-term data then and your real-time data, and how do we incorporate that comparability of looking at that or verifying that?
Thanks, Neera. I think the important thing in all of this is, what you said earlier about that risk-based decisions are on a foundation of strong science. Hmm. So I think in anything in this area where you're talking about incremental process changes, it's very important that you have that strong scientific knowledge of your process and your product, how, changes in certain attributes affect the product and how those changes in the product will impact long-term stability. It's very interesting to see this new text in the draft guideline. Mm. And I think the lines between what we do in terms of stability testing as per ICH Q1 mm-hmm. and what we need to do for biologics in terms of comparability in Q5E will intersect a lot more than they have done in the past. But as I say, key to all of these decision makings and ensuring that your process remains in control is that strong product knowledge the strong analytics that you're getting from your process parameters to make sure that you're staying in control.
And what about yourself, Mark? Have you any thoughts on, you know, this concept of, you know, obviously from a business perspective, very often the earlier materials, whether for clinic or phase one, phase two materials, would not be produced in the final manufacturing site. They're produced maybe not even within their own organization. Maybe a third party is manufacturing at that scale. And then being able to ensure that the ongoing long-term stability at the final site, at the scale that it's being manufactured at, maintains alignment with what may have already gone before.
Yeah, that's a good point. I just echo what Declan says. So I think one of the benefits of a stability-based approach is it gives us the opportunity to focus our resources on things that represent a product risk, product quality risk, or a patient risk. Mm. And one of the nice things about the Q1 guidance is that it does give us some hints and tips about how we might implement that, and to say, right, anything that is unlikely to be a stability indicating attribute, we don't need to worry about. Yep. Let's focus on things that we do. And especially where it's going to be a risk to patient safety, clearly we need to pay very close attention to that. But this approach that we've had historically about ticking regulatory boxes is not particularly productive. Mm. And by the time we get to registration stability and annual stability batches, we should understand how to make our product, and we should understand what's likely to change on stability. Mm. And that knowledge, and of course risk management, is all about knowledge management. It's about understanding product risk. So by that time, we should be in a very good position to understand the stability risk and to design our stability studies accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And of course, that probably feeds into a lot of what we're seeing then for post-approval changes in terms of supporting that, because we now may be spinning a product out into a third party or moving it to a different site, or indeed discharging that license to another authorization holder, market authorization holder.
Yeah, the risk is always about unforeseen consequences of change. So our ability to manage risk in that process is really about our knowledge of the science and how the change that we're making could impact product quality. Where that knowledge is lacking, that's where the risk comes.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, ICH Q14 helps with some of what traditionally was where some of those elements fell down, was in making sure that we have robust analytical methods in the first instance.
You've got it in one, because everything that we do in manufacturing is reliant about appropriate, good quality analytical data, fit for purpose analytical data. So trying to minimise the variability of analytical methods and trying to make sure that the analytics are adequate to support decisions that we make about manufacturing is critical.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly from my own experience, it's often the analytical method that falls down in the transfer, because, as you say, the method gets transferred, but the knowledge doesn't get transferred with it.
That is absolutely true. And also our ability to model stability, of course, depends on lack of variability in analytical data. The more variability we have, the greater uncertainty in the analytical data. That becomes a real problem. So I think a goal for early phase development is to respond to any perceived lack of robustness in the analytical data and make changes then, because by the time we get to registration stability, we should have nailed down all those sources of variability ideally, and we should be working with analytical methods that do a good job for us in modelling stability.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. So I think, Val, it's back to you now at this stage. You're going to look at what's ahead of us.
Yes, before I do that, though, Noel, I've been monitoring the Q&A on the app we're using here at the conference, and there's some really good questions from the audience. So I know I'm catching my panelists on the hop with these questions, but we'll see how we cope with them, because some of them are really, really nice questions. So the first question, perhaps I put it to each or both of you. If you could redesign stability testing from the ground up today with no legacy constraints, with no boulders on our necks from history, what would you keep and what would you completely change? Isn't that a toughie?
So for commercial products, I would change, you know, the burden for annual stability to follow a once annual, or maybe load time points around the proposed expiry date. Yes. Because testing an established product after 3 months
is
makes
telling
nice
you
more
nothing.
Sense.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's the right risk revolution there.
And if we're adopting a risk-based approach, we should be able to use historical data. So there are some products that are rock steady. Mm. Okay, they just, in terms of chemical stability, let's just focus on chemical stability, that they just don't degrade. Once we know that, what's the point in testing a batch every year just to tell us stuff we already know? Mm. So that there ought to be some way in which we can propose to a regulatory authority that, yeah, this. So we're going to drop this from regular stability testing because it's telling us nothing. It's adding no value at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Now, I have a question here as well. What's the most common mistake you see when teams reduce stability time points? I might broaden that out to what's the most common mistake people take when they embrace risk-based approaches, because I think everybody sees risk-based approaches, reduction.
Yeah, I think the most common mistake you see and hear of is, you know, not getting regulatory approval prior to making the change.
Hmm.
So I think either, you know, it should be a request submitted to the agency, say, based on acquired process knowledge, we're proposed to reduce stability schedule, rather than kind of deciding it for yourself and hoping for the best in the regulatory inspection.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the stage of development and how much knowledge you already have, because in early stage development, you could never have enough information. As your knowledge about the product evolves, then you can perhaps trim the stability program accordingly. But lack of knowledge is generally a bad thing. So I would generally want more knowledge than less in early stage until we get to that point where we are comfortable that we know how to make and test our product to achieve consistent quality.
But and this leads to another related question, I suppose. You know, the updated guideline will clearly give us additional flexibility in terms of stability studies. But in that, I'm sure there are trip hazards that some of us can see if we don't think through and consider these flexibilities.
I think, Valerie, this is where you'll come into your own, that we're using the appropriate risk management tools to drive those decisions.
Absolutely. But one thing I was heartened about today, listening to all the presentations here, which were excellent, by the way, and congrats to Q1 Scientific on that and their lineup of speakers, but many were sharing positive responses from the regulatory reviewers in terms of their approaches. And so certainly when the science is on the table, I think all ears are open, and I think, you know, it does seem to be, and doors are open. So I thought that was very, very positive nugget I took from the day. Nuala, I have a question I might put to you actually from the audience, if that's okay, because I think this is right up your alley as well. When transitioning away from time point driven testing, what cultural or mindset changes are required inside quality teams? This is Nuala's specialised topic.
Yeah, it's funny. Culture. I started life in the industry as an engineer, and then went on to embrace regulatory science. So I'm a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde, having been on both sides of the fence. And now I spend most of my time having, you know, the first 20 years of my career being technical. Now I spend most of my time looking at behavioural science around the culture in an organisation to ensure that we're achieving excellence and optimising excellence. So the most important thing is, again, and this is where we really come in with our risk-based approaches, is that we don't use risk as a justification to do less work, which is often, you know, where we see it getting cited. And in fact, I'm working with one organisation at the moment where they have, you know, not had a happy embrace with FDA and have ended up with a citation related to their risk management programme. And the citation was, you are using risk-based, your risk management programme and risk-based approaches to justify poor practice. So you definitely do not want to find yourself on that side of the fence if you're trying to reduce your time points just because stability is seen as a burden rather than a rich resource of process understanding. And so we have to change that mindset to a certain extent, that we are using the stability data to enhance our ability to understand and verify our understanding of our risk control strategy and of our products. Yes, once we are at that stage, we can start to look at reducing the time points, but not because of in order to just reduce the burden of the amount of stability. And I think I have spoken last year, I spoke about the number of regulatory inspection issues that can arise around your stability program. I said it's like the canary in the mine for a regulator coming in, a field inspector, to walk into your QC lab. And I mean, they can literally catch you out on the first question of, show me how many of your stability time points have you missed, have been overdue, and it's sitting there waiting. And yet, stability time points are the one thing on the 1st of January that every lab knows exactly how many of them they have to do for the year, how many tests they have to do. And yet they're the one thing that gets kicked to the curb when everybody else's hair on fire and they have, you know, validations that aren't going according to plan, or, you know, other burdens on the lab. So in terms of changing those time points, you need to ensure that you absolutely have enough data to and not just about this product, but perhaps about your overall suite of products that are comparable, that confirm that it is appropriate for you to reduce your time point. I'd also say, you know, like, weigh up the issue of how many hours of analyst time or equipment is actually being held up in executing the test versus how much time will go into correcting this if you get called up on having, you know, maybe taken a punt on reducing time points when you didn't really have enough data. The amount of time you'll go into fixing that in terms of a deviation and investigation and kappas and justification of all of that, there'll be many more man hours have gone into that than actually stick to the knitting and keep your stability time points appropriately. But of course you can use risk-based approaches to do that, but just don't do it just to reduce the burden. Do it because it's justified and you have enough knowledge to be able to back that up.
Yeah, and we're kind of back to where we started.
We are.
Using a risk question to drive it, yeah, is probably the biggest change of mindset. So, conscious of time, Lula, because we're nearly, time is nearly up, believe, yeah, it or not. We enjoyed this so much. But looking to the future, I'll just add one final question. So, from, again, the audience, which was with respect to AI and the role of AI in the stability space. And do we expect it to accelerate massively, or is it more of a wait and see for now? And I think for myself, if I might just comment on that first, because I was part of the commenting team from the PDA on Annex 22 on AI. And, you know, I think AI has a lot to prove to the regulatory industry, regulators first, and then maybe the whole industry itself. Perhaps some of those sandboxes will occur in product development spaces rather than in commercial spaces first. So I don't see it as a wait and see, but it's not going to, I think, pop into our in-tray tomorrow morning either. So I think, you know, it's a precautionary approach, I think we'll see. But it is a very exciting prospect, what it can do for us. And I think in this space where we have so much data and so many ways we can look at the data, as we learned today, I think it is very exciting. Any thoughts from you guys?
Yeah, I think it's time we embrace AI as a very powerful tool, both in terms of product development and long-term product quality. AI's ability to manage large data pools is, you know, it makes data available, amenable in a very instant manner. So it'd certainly be one for advancing more AI integration into or stability management.
Absolutely. And Mark?
I'm not very well placed to talk about AI, but I do just want to go back to one of the things you were saying earlier. And I think that for me, quality risk assessments are a very underused tool by industry. And I think one of the problems very often with coming a cropper with the regulators is not showing you're working and not showing a justification. And I think use what ICH Q9 gives you to do that. And one of the things it says actually in Q9 is you can't use quality risk management to avoid regulatory obligations. So a well thought out quality risk assessment, don't try and pull a fast one, and then you should be okay.
Yeah,
yes.
I agree.
You're singing our tune.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we're all on the same page here. So listen, closing thoughts. Firstly, a big thank you to our expert guests, Declan and Mark, for sharing their knowledge today. And a huge thank you to the Q1 team for hosting us. And again, one of my takeaway statements, I'm going to be quoting you, Declan, on this. The process is your product. I love it. And it is so important that we think about the integration of the two. So as usual, we'll be back each month with a range of topics and a mix of guest interviews and snippets of what's new. So please do subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. So each new episode will miraculously make its way into your feed. We also have set up a LinkedIn Risk Revolution podcast page. So please do join us there. Feel free to message us there and give us any of your thoughts or ideas for upcoming shows. And most importantly, thank you for listening. So it's a thank you from Nuala.
And thank you from Val. And thank you to our audience here for the great questions as well. Yeah. And for being as quiet as church mice all the way through the podcast. And yet throwing us very supportive faces all the way through it. Go, go. You're doing fine on your first live podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.